You really know about this shit? Little woods and hunting?
With Dad and me used to go every year. One time we went hunting, saw a sign said bear left, so we went home.
Hey, what's happening? Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Sorry about the voice. Got a little strained over the Halloween holiday. Thanks for checking me out on the Bob Show, by the way. That was a lot of fun. Halloween was fun this year. You know, I was going into it thinking I wasn't going to do anything. And it turned out to be maybe the best time I've ever had. The numbers on the show are great right now. The numbers on Bob's live show, he said, were the highest he'd ever had. I had a fun time over there with him, with Sherry as his co-host, with Ghostface in the studio, Neff Campbell, maybe one of the sweetest people I've ever talked to. I had a really good time there. So if you missed that show, you can listen to the replay of The Bob Show either on our site or thebobshow.com. MyLifeIsAFoodie.com, I put a link there, and I added a link to the show download there as well, so you can get it in multiple forms. You can also subscribe to The Bob Show on iTunes. The big news, obviously, besides my voice here, is that our show has been nominated for a Taste Award, which came as a really big surprise to me. I don't know how it happened. Maybe someone was smoking crack. But My Life as a Foodie has been nominated in the Best Comedy Series category in the Viewer's Choice portion of the Taste Awards, which I've got to be, you know, I actually got a chance to attend those awards last year. I was Nathan Lyon's date, and I didn't put out. And that sounds wrong. I was a guest. Yeah, maybe that sounds, that's a better way of putting it. I was his guest. Anyway, it was fun for me to be there and to meet everybody, and I felt like I was part of the crowd. Now, a nomination. I never thought I'd get a nomination, especially not in the comedy category, because the competition in Best Comedy is stiff. You know, a nomination for me, that's the reward. It's going to have to be. As you consider, I'm up against Average Betty, Drinking Made Easy with Zane Lamprey, and there's very little chance for me. But it would be nice to actually win. So if you haven't already, because I've been pimping the hell out of it on Facebook and everywhere else, please take time out of your day to vote for My Life as a Foodie in the Best Comedy Series category at the Taste Awards. I put a link in the website, MyLifeIsAFoodie.com. You can go right to the voting page. I think it's a one-time vote, so you don't have to do it more than once. Don't stuff the ballot box. Just a show of support would be great. I do appreciate that. You can go to TastyAwards.com. You can click on the link to view the 2012 Taste Awards nominees and honorees and place your viewer's choice vote for the show in the Best Comedy Series category. And I thank all of you for your support with that. So Top Chef Texas has premiered. And, you know, again, I thought I wasn't going to say anything about it this year because, honestly, I wasn't sure Top Chef had much gas left in the tank. But, and this is kind of a knock on me because I've got a tendency sometimes of being overly critical about things when I just need to shut the hell up. And I've got to learn to just give things a chance. Like the Chew. Remember I said, that looks like a turd. I'm not going to watch it. I'm not even going to talk about it. So Katrina's DVRing this thing, and she's watching it, and she keeps showing me segments, and it's actually very good. So if I've got a major fault, and I've got a lot of major faults, maybe my biggest one is actually judging things too quickly, not giving them a chance. I tend to judge a book by its cover, and I've got to learn not to do that. Because who the hell am I anyway, you know? Anyway, that's a great show. And so I'm reading the short bios on the Top Chef contestants for Season 9, and they're pretty intriguing. I mean, it looks like there's some serious talent coming this season, but also some cheftestants who look like they're bringing a big bag full of attitude along with their knives. But this is nothing new. Listen, these chefs come in thinking they're going to be the top chef and they're the best. And they have to think this way. Otherwise, I mean, what's the use of coming on in the first place, right? I mean, you don't go into a fight thinking, oh man, I hope I last two rounds before this guy knocks me out. But there's a big difference between being confident and then being arrogant. And a lot of times, you'll hear some very arrogant things coming out of the mouths of these chefs. So I thought it would be funny to do this year. It might be fun to play a bit. Every episode, while Top Chef Season 9 is on the air, every episode, I'm going to do a bit called Shut the F*** Up and Cook. Top Chef Arrogant Quote of the Week.
Get ready for our biggest season ever.
Oh, Jesus. It's so overcooked.
29 chefs have come to Texas to compete in America's most prestigious, toughest culinary competition, Top Chef.
So relaxing.
Oh, you bitch.
Over 8 seasons, Top Chef has catapulted careers, and the winners have gone on to achieve huge success. You are Top Chef.
I am. That was the best reaction ever.
Food and Wine's Best New Chef, a James Beard nominee. 10 new restaurants and countless accolades in the press. While hoping to continue that legacy, this season's chefs must qualify to be one of 16 contestants who will go on and compete across the state of Texas.
Holy 10 seconds.
Cook risotto.
Joining me at judges' table, head judge Tom Colicchio.
That's clever, but is it a good idea?
Food and Wine Magazine's Gail Simmons.
It needs to be delicious.
Chef Hugh Atchison.
You do this every day.
And culinary legend Emeril Lagasse.
And I don't even know what happened to the meat.
We'll narrow the field to the top contenders. At stake for the winner, a feature in Food and Wine Magazine, a showcase at the annual Food and Wine Classic in Aspen. $125,000 furnished by Healthy Choice to bring their culinary dreams to life. And the title of Top Chef.
So it's the very first episode, and right away you can tell who's arrogant, who's confident, and who's just happy to be there and survive another challenge. You root for those who treat other people with respect, of course, and people who have a tendency not to shoot their mouths off. It's okay to be confident, but it's not okay to be, you know, just a complete dick. And you revel in the failures of those who are douchebags. So within 10 minutes of the first episode, the prick of the week is loud and clear. It's this kid named Tyler Stone. He's a 22-year-old chef who thinks he's got this whole thing in the bag. Listen to this intro.
Right now I'm a personal chef caterer, and I'm kind of an entrepreneur.
The name's Stone. Chef Tyler Stone.
I know I'm good. And, you know, a lot of people, they mistake my confidence for arrogance, but that's just because they don't like the fact that I'm as good as I am and half their age, you know?
Okay, so the first challenge is pretty cut and dry, but it's going to involve a bit of butchering. Listen to Tom explain this.
We've broken down an entire pig to its primal cuts. As a group, you'll be creating a feast for us with this very pig.
There are 10 cuts of meat, and there are 10 of you. Now it's up to you to decide who cooks which part of the pig. Some of the pieces contain multiple cuts, so you'll have to work out how you will separate your cuts. Also, you're going to be serving in 3 groups, and you will have an hour to cook your dish.
So Tyler is given the task of butchering this pig, cutting primal pieces into smaller pieces, so the other chef testants can prepare their dishes. Except Tyler, he's a special kind of chef. He doesn't butcher his proteins. Obviously, he comes from a special place where he has someone else doing his dirty work.
Being a personal chef for celebrities, they've got money to spend. So I have a butcher that butchers it exactly how I want it. Regardless, anything I put my mind to, I'm going to accomplish. I've written my own cookbook. Most people wouldn't even know where to begin, and I did it 3.5 weeks. So I know I can slice and dice better than most of these people.
Get a hammer.
I hope they don't up my loin.
You're gonna be fine.
My pork tenderloin is with the chop, and I'm rushing, working on all of the other elements, so I let somebody else butcher my tenderloin.
I need a freaking saw on this bad boy.
Oh, yeah.
So here's this little douchebag cutting the shit out of this perfect rib section. I mean, he's slaughtering this thing into pieces. You could never even serve this. Even at home, I wouldn't serve this. If you were making sausage with it, I don't think it'd be a problem. But when you're preparing chops, loin, ribs, tenderloin for service, it's got to look not just good, but great. And this girl, she needs a nice tenderloin, and Michael Myers over here is hacking this pig into pieces so unevenly. You'd swear he was cutting this whole thing blindfolded.
I'm not exactly sure what's happening with Tyler next to me. I just know that he's the guy that gets the freaking poacher that I want, and he can't butcher, and that just pisses me off because that's the one thing I wanted.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
wrestling with this thing, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's a large piece of meat, and I don't usually butcher whole pieces like this.
When you butcher, what do you usually butcher?
Not usually pork. I don't do pork a lot.
You don't?
An hour is ample time, obviously, to cook a pork chop and a little side dish. When you have to also then butcher in order to get your chop, that kind of throws you off a little bit.
Who's got the tenderloin?
He's got the loin. Go get it.
Thanks. You have the tenderloin? I let Tyler butcher the subprimal that had my tenderloin in it.
Here's some tender. This is, you want that? That's a chop.
I was going to stuff it. He's handing me everything but what I need.
What do you need?
The tenderloin.
I don't see a tenderloin there.
You have the, but yeah, it's all cut up.
What you did is you cut her tenderloin in half.
The tenderloin is just hacked. I have this, like, 3-ounce piece of meat to work with, and that's...
If you went to a butcher shop, right, and you saw something like this, would you buy them?
Probably not, although I'm not a butcher, so...
Well, I know, but you're a chef, and that's, like, a basic skill.
You were butchering for someone else as well?
No, I was just taking off what I needed.
Yeah, but in the meantime, you took her tenderloin and hacked it to death, and so she had barely anything to work with.
We're in a rush, so we gotta get things done.
There's no way that this is gonna get through this round. And I think you should just leave now.
Give me a shot. You'd be surprised.
I'm telling you, you know what? I can't give you a shot. This is not gonna do it.
Come on.
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry.
So I'm done?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pack up your knives and you can go. Okay?
Fair enough.
So Tom Colicchio's seen enough. I mean, much like the poor pig who gave his life for this challenge, for this kid, it's hatchet time.
I see Tyler walking away, and it's like, oh my God, I don't want that to be me. I put my head back down and start working.
Tom and Emerald made a bad decision because they weren't able to taste the expertly cooked pork chop. But I'm not too terribly worried because I know where I'm going. It's right to the top.
This is a serious competition for serious chefs. And if you don't know how to break down the chops, then you deserve to be sent home.
And that's that. And listen, I thought of doing this before I even saw the first episode. So this kid comes on. Within 5 minutes, I'm happier than a pig in shit. Because I'm thinking, oh, this guy's going to give me gems for weeks. But now I'm thinking I might have to dig deeper for quotes. Because so far, I don't see anybody who can possibly compete like this. Top Chef Texas, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern on Bravo. So now, Top Chef's out of the way, I think it's time for us to have some beer. I'm going to be doing, and listen, did you guys hear some of those beers that I brought to Bob's show? I wish I had time to actually talk about them more on the show there. But there was some good stuff there, and I'll revisit those at some point. But there were some really good beers. Antigoon I brought with me. We had that on the last show here. But there were some great beers there. Man, I'll tell you, some are just outrageous. I also brought a Horny Devil from Alesmith. We didn't get a chance to drink that, so when I got home that night, I polished it, and it was fantastic. It's an interesting thing that the brewery is doing. This year, I'm having four calling birds from the brewery. It's their winter seasonal beer. It's a Belgian strong dark ale at 11%. The very first year that Patrick Rue opened the brewery, he brewed a Christmas beer. He called it Partridge in a Pear Tree. And I thought, okay, so that's his Christmas beer. Next year, he calls one Two Turtle Doves. And then the year after that, Three French Hens. So this year, obviously, four calling birds. You've got to wonder what happens, you know, in 12 years' time, when the 12 days of Christmas are finally over. He's going to do 12 drummers drumming. By then, I'm sure we're going to be drinking this damn thing out of a snare drum. Because this guy makes great beer. This beer... Four Calling Birds. It's got a nice tan head. It doesn't stick around, though. There's no lacing on this beer. So, and with some of the beers, some of the seasonals that he does, especially a beer like this, is not going to hold a lot of carbonation. There's next to no lacing, but there's carbonation in it. It smells of the holidays. Cinnamon, nutmeg, ginger, gingerbread man, really sweet malty smells. Not a whole lot of hops. Of course, you know, it's typical for a Belgian strong ale. It's not going to be very, very hoppy. I taste this thing. Tastes like gingerbread men. Nutmeg, cinnamon, cloves, really malty, a little boozy. Very good beer. It's full-bodied, carbonation's really light, like I said, how it should be. You don't want a winter warmer fizzing up like crazy, you know? You're not drinking a refreshing beer here. It's perfect. Crisp, chest-warming, lots of booze in this thing. Thebrewery.com. You know, I've talked about this guy before. I'm going to be talking about him for years. He's already becoming, early on, becoming a very much a legend. I'm going to have to respect that beer, set it aside over here, sip it. And listen, I guess my rant on Occupy Wall Street did not sit well with at least one of my listeners, or ex-listeners, I should say now. So I don't want to go too deep into this one. But Mario Batali ended up talking Occupy Wall Street with Piers Morgan on CNN. Morgan asked whether his restaurants are for the 1%, or the greedy 1%, or GOP for short. Apparently, I sound like a Republican. I've been compared to Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh. Dude, seriously. I mean, that is a swift kick in the balls. Don't ever do that again. In fact, thanks for not listening. Anyway, here's what Mario had to say.
America's going through a rough time at the moment, very obviously. You know, just down the road here in New York, you Occupy Wall Street and everything. Your restaurants appeal very much to what Michael Moore would call the 1%. How are you seeing the economy impact on those people, just from what your business tells you?
Well, I have 19 restaurants, nine of which are around New York City. And we have everything from a pizzeria with a $30 check average to a four-star Italian restaurant with a $160 check average. So we run the kind of bookends on that business. What I must point out, however, in just traveling around the country a little bit and from knowing a lot of my friends in the business, it seems that New York City and Los Angeles are a little bit kind of insulated from the full fallout, even if there is definitely 99% and 1%, or say a real number is more like 90 and 10. Mm. And we're lucky enough to be in a place where, because there's tourism and because there's people not just relying on their own jobs, they're here in New York to try food, to try theater. I mean, I think the theaters are still doing pretty well as well. So anywhere where there's tourists and locals kind of getting together, it kind of makes sense. So it works for us.
You're a fiery individual. You know, you like to be passionate, lose your temper. You're a good businessman. You get things done. You employ people. You're successful. If you were running the country, what would you do to fix this malaise?
I'm not sure. I must say, I think the base of the problem right now is that truly never more than any other time before are we truly 50-50. It's two sides, and both quite adamant. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the Republicans and that guard prepare themselves in a way to present it more like a really successful advertising campaign. And they're also in every knife fight with a knife. I think Obama came in with a really great idea, and I love him, and I love what he represents, but he came into the knife fight without the knife.
You know, we all lost money in that Wall Street debacle. Most of us, present company included, have got a 401k that looks like Swiss cheese now. We paid more money for our house than we probably should have, but we didn't get into it with one of these smoke and mirrors mortgages. You know, I'm proud of that. We didn't buy a house that we couldn't afford. We got a mortgage with a fixed interest rate, not a zero down, 0% APR loan that ended up costing far more in the long run. We're fortunate enough to be working for companies and doing work and for companies that managed to stay alive through all of this and for everything that's happened. Fortunate that we got to keep our jobs. And we're doing everything we can to keep business alive. So why are we being vilified for going out to eat? I mean, why are we being called the greedy 1%? Why are we suddenly all being labeled Republicans? I guess because we're still working, we must be part of the problem. Now, this question to Mario, I thought, was out of line. I'm sorry. I think if you can afford to eat, you go out to eat. Why ask if someone thinks their clientele is only the upper crust? When did this start? I mean, what about these people who buy tickets to a concert? Are you badgering Ticketmaster too? I mean, go badger every person who owns a gas station. It costs $50 or more to fill your car with gas so you can go to the beach or take a trip. Ask them about that. This is food. We go out to eat. And you can ask this question of any business. Grocery stores. All right, that's a stretch, but go ask a grocery store. What do you think of the notion that it costs $130 for a week's worth of groceries? Do you realize that most people don't have $130 to spend on food? And make the grocery store defend its clientele for having money to buy food. That's dumb, man. That's a dumb question. You know what that was? A lazy question. Mario looks like he dropped some weight, too. Damn, he looks fit. And that's saying something. When he was doing his old show on Food Network, he had a face like he swallowed an eggplant. Now he's kind of svelte. I mean, seriously, look at this dude. I mean, not that he couldn't afford to still drop some more weight, but he looks a lot better. Anyway, Piers Morgan has a good show, but I didn't like that question at all. I thought it, I don't know, was a little leading. But I want to talk about Spain today, particularly Spanish food. When we think of Spanish food, people tend to think of the Spanish language, and then it leads you to Mexican food. But it's not the same thing. Spain's in Europe. It's not even close, actually. What we're looking at here is a balance between French food and Italian food. I mean, there's a ton of cured meat, olives, seafood, olive oil, great wine, a ton of peasant dishes like paella or Catalan-style bean stews, fideo, which is basically angel hair pasta that's chopped up into tiny pieces. Lots and lots of pork, especially cured pork. There are a few similarities, but it's about as far from Mexican food as it is from Asian food. It's in its own class. And I'm really beginning to not only appreciate the origins of Spanish food and Spanish cuisine, but I'm really starting to enjoy cooking it. I mean, I've been cooking it off and on for years, but now I really like it. Again, the more you look at European culture, the more you see where we got a lot of our own culture from. And I'm trying to rack my brain on this, but someone commented in the Facebook group on something I had posted or someone else posted about a show that they went back and listened to. I don't know if it was the Bazaar or maybe it was when I talked about Little Spain, that Spanish tapas bar that Don and I visited back in September when we went to Guisados, the taco place. Anyway, she said that she was happy that I liked Spanish food. And she said she's proud of her country's cuisine, but she's not proud of her country in other aspects. Not always, anyway. Now, I don't live in Spain. I'm sure they've got some of the same problems that we have here. People tend to be harder on their own country. You know, we're hard on ours, but that doesn't mean that we don't love it. I mean, I wouldn't want to live anywhere else, but I love a lot of things about Spain. I love their food, their language, their people, their amazing talent for football, soccer, their passion and loyalty to the country, especially when it comes to sports. I think there's nothing to be ashamed of to show pride for your country. And I think we do that a lot here, and I don't think we should be ashamed of that either. But we had a dinner party around Halloween, and as I usually tend to do when we have more than 8 guests, we made it tapas style, so I could just cook, lay out plates, people can graze without having to sit, you know, everyone down and have a serve a formal meal. And I'm starting to get tired of doing that because I don't feel like I'm really enjoying the guests, and they appreciate me keep, you know, getting up and serving, you know, more dishes. People love to graze, and I love to cook like this because it takes the pressure off of having everything. Like, you don't have to time everything. I don't like timing stuff. I just like it's done when it's done. And I tried to make this as Spanish a meal as I could. So I did some traditional tapas. We had assorted seafood tapa with bread. There were baby eels, cockles, mussels, anchovies, olive oil, lots of different olives, some smoked meats, cantipalitos, which is a dry-cured Spanish chorizo, cantimpalos, which is another dry-cured Spanish chorizo. I made goat cheese stuffed piquillo sweet peppers with a balsamic glaze and a blue agave nectar. There were calcots, which are like large green onions, kind of between a green onion and a leek. I grilled those over high heat, burnt the shit out of them. Then I had a homemade aioli and Ruiz sauce to dip them in. I made a white bean stew with cantapalitos, small Spanish cocktail sausages, and my own home-cured ham. There were some Spanish meatballs that I made myself with pork via tortillas, which are potato omelets, frites, assorted cheeses like manchego, a cold tomato and bread salad that we're going to make together here in a second. Tons of food. A great time. I really set the tone for a meal that I love to have in my house. Everybody's eating. Everybody's talking, drinking, having fun, basically falling into a food coma. And like most great food, and I'm referencing the peasant dishes from Italy, France, and Germany, tapas comes from not having a lot of money. You know, they made small portions of food because they didn't have a lot of food to give. Now, of course, you know, we make a lot of small portions, but it's enough to make it seem like we're having appetizers for dinner. And, you know, do you really look forward to the entree? I saw a chart recently. I think it was in Esquire or GQ magazine. It showed the excitement during the meal. And the most exciting part of the meal happens at the beginning, the surprise gift from the chef, a little chef surprise. It spikes with the appetizer or appetizers. Then it dips down when the entree comes, because it's a bummer. It went up a little when dessert arrives, but it plummets by the time you get to the check. And you're still having a good time. But the best part of that good time is coming at the appetizer stage, because that's what we're basically talking about when we talk about tapas. Why is Ludo Bites so popular? People love eating small bites of food and spreading the wealth. We love to taste many different things. We don't leave in a food coma, although I sent my guests into one because I cooked too much food. But you don't have to eat everything. And that's the problem, I think, with entrees. A big piece of chicken and some pasta. Good luck. After eating everything else, I don't think there's a big chance you're going to get through that unless you're really hungry. But with tapas, you don't have to finish. Eating smaller portions is better for us. It's better for your body. It's better for your waistline. And it's fun for the cook because he gets to do a bunch of different stuff. Mushrooms sautéed with garlic and parsley. Fried potatoes with spicy sauce and aioli. Bechamel fritters with chicken, serrano ham, crab, mushrooms. Empanadas, stuffed with chicken and vegetables. Bombas, fried potato balls with beef. Choriquitos al vino, which are Spanish chorizo sautéed in wine and paprika. Pulpo, boiled octopus with potatoes and paprika. Botifarra, a classic Catalan dish, grilled sausage with white beans and bacon. Then there's paella, which Don can make better than anybody else I know. It's rice with saffron, mussels, chicken, sausage, shrimp, calamari, clams. So many great soups, gazpacho being my favorite. Pureed vegetables, tomato, pepper, onions, cucumbers, all blended in olive oil. Sopa de marisco, a seafood stock that has fish, lobster, and vegetables. Breakfast, oh my God. Skip the Grand Slam when you're having breakfast in Spain. No Spanish, no stack of pancakes there. You do it light. Thick hot chocolate with churros. Maybe a fried egg with some smoked chorizo, a few slices of fried potatoes. There's just a different vibe going on there. The charcuterie from Spain drops a total big fat deuce on cured meats from any other country. Jamón, particularly Ibérico de Balota, the most coveted ham in the world. Fouet, salsichón, a black pepper sausage, assorted types of different chorizos. Spain has given us modern cuisine. It gave us the Adria brothers, El Bui, now Tickets, which is the hottest tapas spot in all of Spain right now. Jose Andreas, both here in Los Angeles with the Bazaar, in Washington, D.C. with Mini Bar. Juan Marie Arzac from San Sebastian, the man that Bourdain says he wishes would adopt him. I mean, listen, when people find out you cook, they're going to ask you the same question every time. What do you like to cook the most? And I don't know if they mean what do you like to eat the most, or what do you enjoy cooking the most, or what style of cuisine that you enjoy to cook the most, or what is it that you think defines your cooking? If you ask me what I like to eat the most, it's soup. If you ask me what I enjoy cooking the most, a steak. But a style of cuisine? Definitely French, but I'm really starting to enjoy Spanish food. I want to share with you a clip from Jose Andreas' show, Made in Spain, that was on PBS, and I think it's still on PBS, but it's also available on DVD. But here he is making gazpacho, which is very simple, but he does it with such passion.
And when we talk about Andalucía, we are talking about gazpacho, probably the most international tomato cold soup ever. What we need to do, only very simply, is start prepping all the ingredients, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, garlic, olive oil. And now you're going to be asking, Jose, you are telling me here about a new recipe and you are not even giving me quantities? Hey, recipe sometimes is the worst thing that a home cook can do, following them. Just you need to follow more or less the big guidelines. And here, what we have in this big container, as you see, 3/4 up, fill up with the tomatoes. If you have a smaller container, always follow the same method. 3/4 up of the tomatoes. The next ingredients are going to fill the last 1/4 of this container. The beautiful pepper, and we are going to use probably less than half. Perfect. Seeds out. Also, 1/2 of this cucumber. And with this cucumber, what we're going to do is, with the help of this kind of apple cutter, we're going to take out the inside seeds. Those seeds are going to help me to create a very unique garnish. You see, they're beautiful. And to me, is nothing nicer than the seeds of this cucumber. Oh, you see the texture of those tiny seeds of cucumber? Okay, so we put 1/2 of the cucumber inside here. And now, olive oil. And we're going to put olive oil up to your liking. But to have a long hand on the use of olive oil is going to help you to have a nicer, creamier gazpacho. And the other ingredient that you always have to be using in the perfect gazpacho will be sherry vinegar. And the sherry, you know, has no substitute. And now, a little bit of water, always mineral water, that is going to help you to blend the whole thing even better. And I'm missing one ingredient. This is garlic. And the garlic goes in. And now we are ready to blend. And you know, nothing like to celebrate Andalusia with a great glass of sherry. It's so distinctive, this wine, that you know, don't tell anyone, but I think a tiny drop of this sherry will do wonders to this gazpacho. Take a look at how creamy this gazpacho really is. You see what I was telling you, the olive oil, the pectin, almost looks like a mousse. Wow. It's so good. Well, it's missing actually some salt. Time to blend. All right, and the gazpacho is strained and finished. If you want to elevate this soup, I told you about doing a garnish like this. You see how beautiful those seeds really look? And now make cubes of all the ingredients. I'm having fun with these tiny cubes. A touch of olive oil right in the bottom of the plate. And now we bring the plate to the table. But one ingredient, bread croutons, pan fried with good olive oil, that will add very nice crunchiness to the whole gazpacho. Wow, don't tell me that this soup, this gazpacho, don't really look astonishing.
What I made recently that I'd like to share with you is a recipe from Jose Andreas from his book Made in Spain, which is a companion cookbook to the show on PBS. It ran two seasons. Extra Maduran cold tomato bread salad. It's very simple to prepare, really features the tomato, and was the one dish that I wish I'd made more of because everybody loved it. It was coveted. If you want to buy this cookbook or seasons 1 and 2 of Chef Andreas' show on PBS, I'm going to put links on the website. You can own them from Amazon.com. Truly some very healthy food, very Spanish, very easy to prepare dishes. So to make this cold tomato bread salad, what you're going to need is about 4 ounces of thick sliced rustic bread. 2 thick slices will do it. 6 tablespoons of Spanish extra virgin olive oil. 6 ripe plum tomatoes. 1/2 of a garlic clove that you've peeled. 1/4 teaspoon of sweet pimentón, which is Spanish smoked paprika. 1 tablespoon of chopped flat leaf parsley. Sea salt. 1 tablespoon of sherry vinegar. 1 green bell pepper that you've seeded and sliced. 1 scallion, thinly sliced. And then 1 cup of quartered green olives. You start by preheating the oven to 400, and then cut the bread into 1-inch cubes and toss it in a mixing bowl with 2 tablespoons of the olive oil. Spread the bread on a baking sheet and then bake on the middle rack of the oven until golden brown, about 5 minutes. And you've got these nice croutons that you just set aside to cool. Take 4 of the tomatoes, cut them in half, place a grater over a mixing bowl, and rub the cut surface of the tomatoes over the grater until all of the flesh is grated, and then discard the skin. Spoon the tomato pulp into a fine mesh strainer set over a large bowl and allow the pulp to kind of drain there for about 30 minutes. Reserve the drained pulp, dice the remaining tomatoes. Using a mortar and pestle, smash the garlic together with the pimentón, parsley, and a pinch of salt to make a nice smooth paste. The salt actually stops the garlic from slipping in the bottom of the mortar as you pound it down. Actually, Don showed me this trick, and it's pretty impressive how salt just stops everything. Plus, it helps season it, too. Whisk about 3 tablespoons of olive oil and the vinegar together in a small bowl, and then stir in the garlic and parsley paste. In a mixing bowl, combine the croutons, the peppers, the diced tomatoes, the scallions, and the olives. Toss it all together, pour in the dressing, and mix it really well. To serve it, you just spread the reserved tomato pulp on a serving platter and then drizzle with the remaining tablespoon of olive oil. Top it with the tomato bread salad and then season it with a little bit of salt, maybe a little pepper if you want. And that's the dish. It's very easy to prepare. It's a great side dish. It might even be a great main dish if you just want to do a vegetarian option. I know this whole thing of meatless Mondays is coming around. And if there's one thing I truly appreciate, not only about Spanish food, but especially about this cookbook, Made in Spain, is that there are so many vegetable options here. I mean, if you're racking your head on how to make, you know, vegetable options or side dishes, or, you know, if you're trying to do meatless Mondays, this book's full of great ideas. And just like France, you know, there was this whole area that, when they talked about Provence, there was an episode of Bourdain's show, and he said that they ate mostly vegetables and they dipped them in aioli. And that was their meal most times. They had protein maybe once or twice a week if they were lucky, because they were poor and proteins are expensive. So vegetables were a cheap option. And I think sometimes food that comes from peasant places turns out to be the best thing possible. And that's one of the things maybe I love the most about Spain and Spanish cooking.
For me, I'm sort of into a Spanish, as in sort of Spain, Portugal, because there's a lot of really interesting food there that has been around, and very different. The Basque Country is much different than food from Barcelona, much different than Madrid. So and Lisbon is much different than Porto. So I'm kind of in between those two countries right now. But also, I think the whole farm and understanding of farmers markets and farm to table is really sort of the trend of what's happening right now. So we'll see what happens.
See, even Emerald loves it. Hey, so that documentary that I was a part of on molecular gastronomy from the USC Impact documentary series, they were able to finally release that online. I guess what happens, and that she explained this to me, is that they show the episode on television. Okay, it's on a bunch of cable channels, and they've got to wait like 90 days or longer after its release before they can actually publish the videos online. So the delay was finally lifted. They were able to release it. And I posted it on mylifeasafoodie.com. So if you'd like to check it out, I think it's like 12 minutes long. I'm really proud of it. And I, you know, there's a lot going on last week, which is part of the reason why I lost my voice here. But, you know, I think maybe I came off a little too excited about molecular gastronomy. Maybe too definite that this is the future of food. What I meant by this is that by cooking like this, by making memories, surprising people with food, tastes, different textures, that's the future of food. To a certain extent, entertainment, because that's one of the things that I learned in the molecular gastronomy class. I'm not here to feed you. I'm here to entertain you. I'm here to make memories. One of the things that I said in the interview with her that didn't make it into the documentary, and I wish it did, was that the reason I cook like this is because I want you to remember being at my house for dinner. I told her, you know, I could have you over 5 times, and maybe one time I'll make stew, we'll have chicken, another time maybe pizza or pasta, but in one of those meals, I'm going to do something to surprise you, like the mango coconut egg, or the deconstructed virgin pina colada, or the you know, the cereal milk flan thing. I'll surprise you with that, and you're going to have this experience, and I don't think you're going to forget it. You might forget the plate of pasta I made, or the chicken, or the time we grilled steaks, or the stew. But you're going to remember that egg, because it made you laugh, and it had a memorable impact. That is the key. And especially if you're a home cook and you're doing this for your guests. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I got excited about it. I thought, man, this is great. It'll be fun for everybody. And I read this article recently of this guy. He went to Grant Achatt's new restaurant Next. And he went into it with a preconceived notion about the place, about Grant himself. And he's like, all right, where do we go here? And, you know, it's going to be a long night. The chef's going to show off. He's going to force his taste on me. It's going to go on for hours. And in the end, it shocked him. He said it was one of the most memorable dining experiences of his life. And this guy's a food critic, making memories. Or maybe bringing memories back. That's the point. And what I meant when I said that modernist cuisine was the future of food, you know, that's what happened because of molecular gastronomy, and the compounds that came from that research allowed us to change the way we eat. And Jesus Christ, did you hear malarkey? we discovered these compounds that suddenly were keeping canned food on the shelf longer. Now it's bad for you, blah, blah, blah. And by the way, we use some of that shit in our restaurant. No kidding. Now, what's your point then? And what's hilarious to me is that people who are into modernist cuisine don't have a hard-on for people who just cook regular food, who don't practice this style. But there are people who don't practice this style who hate modernist cuisine, like Malarkey. Malarkey wouldn't have been in that documentary had I not told her about him in the first place. I met this guy at a food and wine event years ago, and I asked him his take on molecular gastronomy, and he went off. I think at the time, we were in the season when Michael Vitaggio had the upper edge, and he was using a lot of molecular techniques. And he was talking about Kevin, who he was competing against, and he said that he was really rooting for Kevin because he hates molecular gastronomy. He went off, man. He said he wanted to see molecular gastronomy abolished from professional kitchens and that he is actively pursuing that himself. And that's the first time I ever saw a chef that passionate about hating another cooking style and chefs that perform and practice those styles. Then I interviewed Eddie Shepard earlier this year. He told me that story. If you remember that chef that he works with, that said if he could, he'd beat Heston Blumenthal to death with a pipe. What the fuck? Well, listen, man, I piss on Paula Deen a lot. I don't want to see her hurt. Although it was funny to see her take a ham to the face that time, but I would never wish anything like that on her. Not her or anybody else. In fact, I'm done with all of that for a while. It's been fun, but it's time to focus on real cooking because I don't know what in the hell it is she does, but I'm not even interested. You know, someone posted a warning sign that they saw at McDonald's. I believe it was on a Happy Meal container. It was on Facebook. It looks serious enough for me to look into and want to talk about it. Here's what the warning said. I'm going to pull it up here. The warning said, chemicals known to cause cancer or birth defects or other reproductive harm may be present in foods or beverages sold or served here. Cooked potatoes that have been browned, such as French fries, hash browns, or baked potatoes, contain acrylamide, a chemical known to the state of California to cause cancer. Other foods sold here, such as hamburger buns, biscuits, and coffee, also contain acrylamide, but generally in lower concentrations than fried potatoes. Acrylamide is not added to our foods, but is created whenever potatoes and certain other foods are browned. The FDA has not advised people to stop eating baked potatoes, fried potatoes, or other foods which contain acrylamide. For information, see FDA.gov. So I did some research on this. Apparently, it's not just McDonald's. This isn't a McDonald's thing. It's an everybody thing. A similar sign was found in Starbucks. I guess acrylamide can be produced when coffee beans are roasted. And this is something that affects business right here in the state of California because they passed Proposition 65, which is how this all came about. And I must be living under a rock because I've never seen these signs anywhere. Granted, I don't remember the last time I was actually in a McDonald's, but I've never seen a sign like this at Starbucks. And I'm in one of those a few times a month at least. Acrylamide is on the Proposition 65 list of chemicals known to the state of California to cause cancer or reproductive toxicity, such as birth defects and other reproductive harm. For years, acrylamide has been used in grouts and cements, pulp, and other paper production or processing, permanent press fabrics, and dye manufacture. It's also used in water and wastewater treatment, soil conditioning, and oil drilling. Acrylamide is also present in tobacco smoke. In 2002, Swedish researchers discovered that acrylamide forms during the baking, frying, or roasting of certain kinds of foods, particularly starchy foods. Acrylamide is not added to foods. It's a contaminant that forms during the baking, frying, or roasting of certain plant-based foods. Boiling and steaming foods does not create acrylamide. French fries, potato chips, or other fried and baked snack foods, roasted asparagus, canned sweet potatoes and pumpkin, canned black olives, roasted nuts, coffee, roasted grain-based coffee substitutes, prune juice, breakfast cereals, crackers, cookies, bread crusts, and toasts all contain varying levels of acrylamide. A number of scientific studies indicate that acrylamide can cause cancer in laboratory animals, and available information indicates that significant exposure to acrylamide poses a cancer risk in humans. Until the discovery of acrylamide in food, concern about the chemical's potential health effects centered on workers who handle the chemical. It now appears that virtually everyone is regularly exposed to acrylamide through the food that they eat. The U.S. National Toxicology Program offers the following tips for reducing acrylamide exposure. Fry foods at 338 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. Thank you. There is no way you're going to make crispy French fries at 338 degrees. And if you don't believe me, watch the French fries episode of Dude Food. Cook potato strips such as French fries to a golden yellow rather than a golden brown color. Again, thanks for telling me to make French fries that suck. Toast spread to the lightest color acceptable. Now listen, I haven't eaten burnt toast since my mother stopped making me grilled cheese sandwiches. And that woman would burn everything. God bless her. She burnt everything, including salad and ice water. I mean, I love my mom, but man, who knew all that time burnt toast? She was making me burnt toast. It could have been giving me cancer. They also say you should soak raw potato slices in water for 15 to 30 minutes before frying or roasting. Drain and blot dry before cooking. This is a good practice anyway. It makes your potatoes less starchy. Yeah, finally, they got one right. Lastly, they say don't store raw potatoes in the refrigerator. That's also another good practice. You shouldn't do that anyway. And these people must be listening to the show. So, because I know this isn't boring enough, here's a lawyer talking about Proposition 65. Try not to fall asleep, but listen how these businesses are getting screwed over.
What does Proposition 65 require? Well, if a product has a listed chemical in it, then the manufacturer, the distributor, and the retailer are required to provide clear and understandable warnings about the presence of those chemicals so that Californians can make informed decisions about whether or not to use those products. There are lawyers out there right now and their staff going around to stores and testing products, primarily consumer goods. Oftentimes they're doing wipe tests and they are finding that these products contain what are often trace amounts of chemicals in them, but they are amounts that are in violation of California's Proposition 65. The bulk of the litigation and the activity is focused upon the warnings requirements. These rules apply to businesses that are doing business in the state of California and that have more than 10 employees. The penalties for a violation of Proposition 65 can be significant. The statute says that the penalties can be $25,000 per violation per day. And so if you think about the number of products that might be sold or the number of exposures that might take place, the number can get pretty large pretty fast. There are some businesses for whom it is almost a bet the company type of situation if a Proposition 65 case is brought against them. We've developed some strategies for working with the plaintiff's attorney and working with the attorney general to bring these companies into compliance as quickly and efficiently as possible to reduce their transactional costs and business costs and to comply with the law. But it's very important that they act as soon as they can to retain competent legal counsel to conduct an analysis of the legal issues and for the guidance that can be provided to the business about how to determine whether or not the product is in violation of Proposition 65 or not.
Listen, if you want to know what's wrong with this country, you don't have to look much further than this. Holy shit, they're burying us with litigation. Do you remember what Julia Child said about McDonald's French fries? She said when they first came out, she loved them because they used to make them by frying them and rendered beef fat. But now they use polyunsaturated fats, which improve blood cholesterol levels, decreases your risk of heart disease or type 2 diabetes. So because of that, and they got healthy, their fries suck now, and she didn't like them anymore.
I like McDonald's. I think they're very careful, and I think if they have a, you know, you buy a franchise, I think you only have a certain amount so that you're in charge and they have their standards and so forth. And I thought when they first started out, the French fries were very good. And then the nutritionists got at them, which turned out to be erroneous, that beef tallow fat was bad and that lard was bad and so forth. And so they changed it to some kind of a nutritionist oil. And they've been kind of limp ever since. I never really eat them, which is too bad. And I always am very strong about criticizing it, hoping maybe they'll change.
And listen, I'm not sticking up for McDonald's here. I'm sticking up for our right to good French fries and coffee. Because listen, when the war starts against good food, I'm going to stand next to that creepy clown, Ronald McDonald. I'll fight to the death because this is some bullshit. We've been eating toast, French fries, and coffee for years. All of a sudden, we think they might be linked to cancer, so we're going to tell businesses that they've got to post warnings to scare people that eating their food might give you cancer. Who the hell wins in this deal? I don't know about you, but a life without French fries, coffee, and charred steak? That's a life I don't feel like living. These litigators hate life. That's what I think. I'd like to know how many of them are giving up coffee. I got to think that number's pretty low. And these the worst thing about these propositions is that, you know, soon we're not going to want to live anymore, but we can't put a gun in our mouth because they've banned the sale of bullets. It's like living in a rat maze that you can't get out of. And with that, I'm done for the day. Thanks for listening. Thanks to CNN for the audio. Music in this episode by Morgan Page. If you like the song, you can buy it in the iTunes store or from Amazon.com. Click the link on our website, MyLifeIsAFoodie.com. You can buy the song for 99 cents. Support the band. Don't forget that My Life as a Foodie is now available on Stitcher. Listen to the show on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, and WebOS phones. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in the App Store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Until next time, my name is Phil, and this has been My Life as a Foodie.
Different place, different time.